Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. This week, we finish up the investigative reporting done by reporter David Epstein about the gap between scientific evidence and the way doctors sometimes practice medicine, the unfortunate continuation of unnecessary or even harmful drugs and procedures in the face of contradictory evidence. Written for ProPublica and published by The Atlantic on February 22, 2017, this article is titled, When Evidence Says No, But Doctors Say Yes. Much of the first half of the article focused on case histories and studies on the practice of implanting stents to shore up narrowed arteries. Stunningly, even when there is no extra monetary benefit for the cardiologist, many continue to implant stents even after they've been shown the numerous studies proving that stents provide no benefit for stable patients, that stents in stable patients did not prevent heart attacks or death. Most said they would continue to perform the procedure. When asked why they would, they said a stent just made intuitive sense to them. You see a narrowing, so it should work better if it is unblocked. While this may work for household plumbing, apparently it does not work for most human heart plumbing problems. This notion that something should work because intuition suggests it should work is called bioplausible in the scientific community. Now, as we start part two of this article, we delve into some other bioplausible areas of medicine, such as the function of blood pressure medications. And we start here. Chances are you or someone in your family has taken medication or undergone a procedure that is bioplausible but does not work. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about one in three American adults have high blood pressure. Blood pressure is a measure of how hard your blood is pushing on the sides of vessels as it moves through your body. The harder the pushing, the more strain on your heart. People with high blood pressure are at enormously increased risk for heart disease, the nation's number one killer, and stroke number three. So it's not hard to understand why Sir James Black won a Nobel Prize largely for his 1960s discovery of beta blockers, which slow the heart rate and reduce blood pressure. The Nobel Committee lauded the discovery as the greatest breakthrough when it comes to pharmaceuticals against heart illness since the discovery of digitalis 200 years ago. In 1981, the FDA approved one of the first beta blockers, atenolol, after it was shown to dramatically lower blood pressure. Atenolol became such a standard treatment that it was used as a reference drug for comparison with other blood pressure drugs. In 1997, a Swedish hospital began a trial of more than 9,000 patients with high blood pressure who were randomly assigned to take either atenolol or a competitor drug that was designed to lower blood pressure for at least 4 years. The competitor drug group had fewer deaths, 204, than the atenolol group, 234, and fewer strokes, 232, compared with 309. But the study also found that both drugs lowered blood pressure by the exact same amount. So why wasn't the vaunted atenolol saving more people? The odd result prompted a subsequent study, which compared atenolol with sugar pills. It found that atenolol didn't prevent heart attacks or extend life at all. It just lowered blood pressure. According to ProPublica's Medicare prescription database, in 2014, atenolol was prescribed to more than 2.6 million Medicare beneficiaries, ranking it the 31st most prescribed drug out of 3,362 drugs. One doctor, Chin Hun, a family practitioner in Westminster, California, wrote more than 1,100 atenolol prescriptions in 2014 for patients over 65, making him one of the most prolific prescribers in the country. Reached at his office, Hun said, "Atenolol is very common for hypertension. It's not just me. When asked why he continues to prescribe Atenolol so frequently in light of the randomized controlled trials that showed its ineffectiveness, Hun said, "I read a lot of medical magazines, but I didn't see that." Hun added that his patients are doing fine with it and asked that any relevant journal articles be faxed to him. Brown, the Washington University cardiologist, says that once doctors get out of training, it's a job and they're trying to earn money and they don't necessarily keep up. So really, major changes have to be generational. Data compiled by Quintiles IMS, which provides information and technology services to the healthcare industry, show that Atenolol prescriptions consistently fell by 3 million per year over a recent 5-year period. If that rate holds, Atenolol will stop being prescribed in just under 2 decades, since high-quality trials showed that it simply does not work. Just as the cardiovascular system is not a kitchen sink, the musculoskeletal system is not an erector set. Cause and effect is frequently elusive. Consider the knee, that most bedeviling of joints. A procedure known as arthroscopic partial meniscectomy, or APM, accounts for roughly 500,000 procedures per year at a cost of around $4 billion. A meniscus is a crescent-shaped piece of fibrous cartilage that helps stabilize and provide cushioning for the knee joint. As people age, they often suffer tears in the meniscus that are not from any acute injury. APM is meant to relieve knee pain by cleaning out damaged pieces of a meniscus and shaving the cartilage back to crescent form. This is not a fringe surgery. In recent years, it has been one of the most popular surgical procedures in the hemisphere, and a burgeoning body of evidence says that it does not work for the most common varieties of knee pain. Something like the knee version of the oculostenotic reflex takes hold. A patient comes in with knee pain, and an MRI shows a torn meniscus. Naturally, the patient wants it fixed, and the surgeon wants to fix it and send the patient for physical therapy. And patients do get better, just not necessarily from the surgery. A 2013 study of patients over 45 conducted in 7 hospitals in the United States found that APM followed by physical therapy produced the same results as physical therapy alone for most patients. Another study at 2 public hospitals and 2 physical therapy clinics found the same result 2 years after treatment. A unique study at 5 orthopedic clinics in Finland compared APM with sham surgery. That is, surgeons took patients with knee pain to operating rooms, made incisions, faked surgeries, and then sewed them back up. Neither the patients nor the doctors evaluating them knew who had received real surgeries and who was sporting a souvenir scar. A year later, there was nothing to tell them apart. The sham surgery performed just as well as real surgery, except that in the long run, the real surgery may increase the risk of knee osteoarthritis. Also, it's expensive, and while APM is exceedingly safe, surgery plus physical therapy has a greater risk of side effects than just physical therapy. At least 1/3 of adults over 50 will show meniscal tears if they get an MRI, but 2/3 of those will have no symptoms whatsoever. For those who do have pain, it may be from osteoarthritis, not the meniscus tear. They would never know they had a tear if not for medical imaging, but once they have the imaging, they may well end up having surgery that doesn't work for a problem they don't have. For obvious reasons, placebo-controlled trials of surgeries are difficult to execute. The most important question, then, is why, when the highest level of evidence available contradicts a common practice, does little change? For one, the results of these studies do not prove that the surgery is useless, but rather that it is performed on a huge number of people who are unlikely to get any benefit. Meniscal tears are as diverse as the human beings they belong to, and even large studies will never capture all the variation that surgeons see. There are compelling real-world results that show the surgery helps certain patients. I think it's an extremely helpful intervention in cases where a patient does not suffer from the constant ache of arthritis, but has sharp intermittent pain and a blockage of motion, says John Cristoforetti, a prominent orthopedic surgeon in Pittsburgh. But when you're talking about the average inactive American who suffers gradual onset knee pain and has full motion, many of them have a meniscal tear on MRI, and they should not have surgery as initial treatment. Still, the surgery, like some others meant for narrower uses, is common even for patients who don't need it. And patients themselves are part of the problem. According to interviews with surgeons, many patients they see want and even demand to be operated upon, and will simply shop around until they find a willing doctor. Cristoforetti recalls one patient who traveled a long way to see him, but was absolutely not a candidate for an operation. Despite the financial incentive to operate, he explained to the patient and her husband that the surgery would not help. She left with a smile on her face, Cristoforetti says. But literally as they're checking out, we got a ding that someone had rated us on a website, and it's her husband. He's been typing on his phone during the visit, and it's a 1-star rating. That I'm this insensitive guy he wouldn't let operate on his dog. They'd been online, and they firmly believed she needed this one operation, and I was the guy to do it. So, what do surgeons do? Most of my colleagues, Cristoforetti says, will say, look, save yourself the headache, just do the surgery. None of us are going to be upset with you for doing the surgery. Your bank account's not going to be upset with you for doing the surgery. Just do the surgery. Randomized, placebo-controlled trials are the gold standard of medical evidence, but not all RCTs, as they are known, are created equal. Even within the gold standard, well-intentioned practices can muddle a study. That is particularly true with crossover trials, which have become popular for cancer drug investigations. In cancer research, a crossover trial often means that patients in the control group who start on a placebo are actually given the experimental drug during the study if their disease progresses. Thus, they are no longer a true control group. The benefit of a crossover trial is that it allows more people with severe disease to try an experimental drug. The disadvantage is the possibility that the study is altered in a manner that obscures the efficacy of the drug being tested. In 2010, on the strength of a crossover trial, Prevenge became the first cancer vaccine approved by the FDA. A cancer vaccine is a form of immunotherapy in which a patient's own immune system is spurred by a drug to attack cancer cells. Given the extraordinary difficulty of treating metastatic cancer and high expectations following the abject failure of other cancer vaccines, the approval of Prevenge was greeted with ecstatic enthusiasm. One scientific paper heralded as the gateway to an exciting new paradigm. Except, Prevenge did not hinder tumor growth at all, and it's hard to know if it really works. Prevenge was approved based on the IMPACT study, a randomized placebo-controlled trial initially meant to see whether Prevenge could stop prostate cancer from progressing. It didn't. 3.5 months into the study, the cancers of patients who had received Prevenge and those who had received a placebo had advanced similarly. Nonetheless, patients who received Prevenge ultimately had a median survival time of about 4 months longer than those who received the placebo. Due to the way in which the IMPACT trial unfolded, however, it's hard to tell if Prevenge was truly responsible for the life extension. Because Prevenge did not halt tumor growth, many of the patients who began the study on it also started to receive docetaxel, a chemotherapy drug that is well established to treat advanced prostate cancer. The cancers of the patients on a placebo were also progressing, so they were crossed over and given Prevenge after a delay. Their cancer continued progressing, and after another delay, many of them also got docetaxel. In the end, fewer patients in the group that started on a placebo received docetaxel, and when they did, they got it later in the study. So, Prevenge may have worked, but it's impossible to tell for sure. Was the slightly longer survival of one group because they got Prevenge earlier, or because the other group got docetaxel later? The year after Prevenge was approved, the federal government's Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality issued a technology assessment report examining all of the evidence regarding Prevenge efficacy. The report says there is moderate evidence that Prevenge effectively treats cancer, but it also highlighted the fact that more patients who got Prevenge at the beginning of the seminal trial also received more and earlier chemotherapy. The report concludes that the effect of Prevenge is apparent only in the context of a substantial amount of eventual chemotherapeutic treatment. In other words, it is unclear which effects in the trial were due to Prevenge and which were due to chemotherapy. The people who went on docetaxel went on it because their disease was progressing. So you've already broken the randomization, says Elise Berliner, director of HARQ's Technology Assessment Program. Prasad, the oncologist who advocates for higher standards of pre-approval evidence, is less diplomatic. If the treatment were pixie sticks, you'd have a similar effect. One group gets pixie sticks, and when their cancer progresses, they get a real treatment. The larger issue has nothing to do with Prevenge specifically, but about the way it gained FDA approval. Therapies are frequently approved for use based on clinical trials that can't actually prove whether they work. Clinical trials almost all have issues like this one, Berliner says. But it's very hard to do randomized controlled trials after drugs are approved. According to a new paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association Oncology, even when cancer drugs clearly do work in trials, they often don't work or work substantially less well in the real world, perhaps because subjects in trials are not representative of typical patients. Berliner is hoping to expand and improve registries that track large numbers of real-world patients as an additional source of information. I've been here for 15 years producing these reports, she says, and I'm getting frustrated. Ideally, findings that suggest a therapy works and those that suggest it does not would receive attention commensurate with their scientific rigor, even in the earliest stages of exploration. But academic journals, scientists, and the media all tend to prefer research that concludes that some exciting new treatment does indeed work. Medicine can be like wine. Expense is sometimes a false signal of quality. On an epical scale, even the greatest triumphs of modern medicine, like the polio vaccine, had a small impact on human health compared with the impact of better techniques for sanitation and food preservation. Due to smoking and poor lifestyle habits, lung cancer, which killed almost no Americans in the early 20th century, is today by far the biggest killer among cancers. Thankfully, public pressure to curb smoking has put lung cancer deaths in rapid decline since a peak in the 1990s. Deaths from lung cancer should continue to diminish, as they are tightly correlated to smoking rates, but with a 20-year lag. That is, lung cancer deaths will decline 20 years after smoking rates decline. The health problems that most commonly afflict the American public are largely driven by lifestyle habits, smoking, poor nutrition, and lack of physical activity, among others. In November, a team led by researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital pooled data from tens of thousands of people in four separate health studies from 1987 to 2008. They found that simple, moderate lifestyle changes dramatically reduced the risk of heart disease, the most prolific killer in the country, responsible for one in every four deaths. People deemed at high familial risk of heart disease cut their risk in half if they satisfied three of the following four criteria: didn't smoke, even if they smoked in the past, weren't obese, although they could be overweight, exercised once a week, ate more real food and less processed food. Fitting even two of those categories still substantially decreased risk. In August, a report issued by the International Agency for Research on Cancer concluded that obesity is now linked to an extraordinary variety of cancers, from thyroids and ovaries to livers and colons. At the same time, patients and even doctors themselves are sometimes unsure of just how effective common treatments are, or how to appropriately measure and express such things. Graham Walker, an emergency physician in San Francisco, co-runs a website staffed by doctor volunteers called the NNT that helps doctors and patients understand how impactful drugs are and often are not. NNT is an abbreviation for number needed to treat, as in, how many patients need to be treated with a drug or procedure for one patient to get the hoped-for benefit. In almost all popular media, the effects of a drug are reported by relative risk reduction. To use a fictional illness, for example, say you hear on the radio that a drug reduces your risk of dying from Hogwarts disease by 20%, which sounds pretty good. Except that means if 10 in 1,000 people who get Hogwarts disease normally die from it, and every single patient goes on the drug, 8 in 1,000 will die from Hogwarts disease. So, for every 500 patients who get the drug, one will be spared death by Hogwarts disease. Hence, the NNT is 500. That might sound fine, but if the drug's NNH, number needed to harm, is, say, 20, and the unwanted side effect is severe, then 25 patients suffer serious harm for each one who is saved. Suddenly, the trade-off looks grim. Now consider a real and familiar drug, aspirin. For elderly women who take it daily for a year to prevent a first heart attack, aspirin has an estimated NNT of 872 and an NNH of 436. That means if 1,000 elderly women take aspirin daily for a decade, 11 of them will avoid a heart attack. Meanwhile, twice that many will suffer a major gastrointestinal bleeding event that would not have occurred if they hadn't been taking aspirin. As with most drugs, though, aspirin will not cause anything particularly good or bad for the vast majority of people who take it. That is the theme of the medicine in your cabinet. It likely isn't significantly harming or helping you. Most people struggle with the idea that medicine is all about probability, says Aaron Souza, an internist and senior associate dean at Michigan State University's medical school. As to the more common metric, relative risk, it's horrible, Souza says. It's not just drug companies that use it, physicians use it too. They want their work to look more useful, and they genuinely think patients need to take this drug. And relative risk is more compelling than NNT. Relative risk is just another way of lying. Even remedies that work extraordinarily well can be less impressive when viewed via NNT. Antibiotics for a sinus infection will resolve symptoms faster in 1 of 15 people who get them, while 1 in 8 will experience side effects. A meta-analysis of sleep aid drugs in older adults found that for every 13 people who took a sedative like Ambien, one had improved sleep, about 25 minutes per night on average, while 1 in 6 experienced a negative side effect, with the most serious being increased risk for car accidents. There's this cognitive dissonance, or almost professional depression, Walker says. You think, oh my gosh, I'm a doctor. I'm going to give all these drugs because they help people. But I've almost become more fatalistic, especially in emergency medicine. If we really wanted to make a big impact on a large number of people, Walker says, we'd be doing a lot more diet and exercise and lifestyle stuff. That was by far the hardest thing for me to conceptually appreciate before I really started looking at studies critically. Historians of public health know that most of the life expectancy improvements in the last 2 centuries stem from innovations in sanitation, food storage, quarantines, and so on. The so-called first public health revolution from 1880 to 1920 saw the biggest lifespan increase predating antibiotics or modern surgery. In the 1990s, the American Cancer Society's Board of Directors put out a national challenge to cut cancer rates from a peak in 1990. Encouragingly, deaths in the United States from all types of cancer since then have been falling. Still, American men have a ways to go to return to 1930s levels. Medical innovation has certainly helped. It's just that public health has more often been the society-wide game changer. Most people just don't believe it. In 2014, two researchers at Brigham Young University surveyed Americans and found that typical adults attributed about 80% of the increase in life expectancy since the mid-1800s to modern medicine. The public grossly overestimates how much of our increased life expectancy should be attributed to medical care, they wrote, and is largely unaware of the critical role played by public health and improved social conditions determinants. This perception, they continued, might hinder funding for public health, and it may also contribute to overfunding the medical sector of the economy and impede efforts to contain healthcare costs. It is a loaded claim, but consider the $6.3 billion 21st Century Cures Act, which recently passed Congress to widespread acclaim. Who can argue with a law created in part to bolster cancer research? Among others, the heads of the American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Public Health Association. They argue against the new law because it will take $3.5 billion away from public health efforts in order to fund research on new medical technology and drugs, including former Vice President Joe Biden's cancer moonshot. The new law takes money from programs like vaccination and smoking cessation efforts that are known to prevent disease and moves it to work that might eventually treat disease. The bill will also allow the FDA to approve new uses for drugs based on observational studies or even summary-level reviews of data submitted by pharmaceutical companies. Prasad has been a particularly trenchant and public critic, tweeting that the only people who don't like the bill are people who study drug approval safety and who aren't paid by pharma. Perhaps that's social media hyperbole. Medical research is, by nature, an incremental quest for knowledge, initially exploring avenues that quickly become dead ends or a feature, not a bug in the process. Hopefully, the new law will in fact help speed into existence cures that are effective and long-lived, but one lesson of modern medicine should now be clear: ineffective cures can be long-lived too. Thank you for tuning into Sound Body. Stay well and come back next week for Healthy Living Ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, WXXI.org.